It is now up to Donald Trump to earn the votes of those in our party and beyond it who did not support it. This is now his time for choosing.
Yeah. I'm sure he'll do the right thing. He'll reach out. He'll be very uniting. That's what he
does.
Well,
I don't know why I came here tonight.
Am I right?
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
I'm not right.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me. Jokers to the right. Here I am stuck in the middle with you.
Oh, hey. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and elsewhere in California, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Hawaii, Ohio, New York, New Orleans, New Mexico, New Hampshire, Arkansas, Seattle, West Virginia, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. Yeah, we got that much show again today. Got to run right through it. Welcome to the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us today for another Bradcast. Mostly thank Desi Doyen for joining us today for another Bradcast, given how you're feeling. You're doing okay?
I'm feeling just fine. I sound weird, but I feel okay.
So. Well, my cold's getting better. Your cold's getting worse.
It is what it is.
And you're welcome. As you know by now, voters in 15 states and one U.S. territory on Tuesday, Super Tuesday, went to the polls or the caucuses, or they mailed a ballot in Alabama, Alaska, Arkansas, California, Colorado, Maine, Massachusetts, Minnesota, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Vermont, Virginia, and yes, the territory of American Samoa with a surprise finish. But we begin our coverage today with this guy from just a few years ago, just after he'd voted against the second impeachment of Donald J. Trump on the supposed basis that, well, since he was no longer in office by that time, by the time the Senate trial was held, such an impeachment was improper, but that there was still a criminal justice system that could and would hold him to account for the insurrection that was incited by Trump on January 6, 2021, that a 57-43 bipartisan majority, by the way, of the U.S. Senate agreed had been incited that day by Donald Trump. So let's start with this guy.
There's no question, none, that President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of the day. No question about it. We have a criminal justice system in this country. We have civil litigation. And former presidents are not immune from being accountable by either one.
You sure?
President Trump is still liable for everything he did while he was in office. As an ordinary citizen, didn't get away with anything. Yet.
That guy, Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who condemned the then president of the United States for inciting an insurrection against the U.S. Capitol and the seat of U.S. government itself, who said that Donald J. Trump was, quote, morally responsible for what happened on January 6th, but who voted against impeachment and barring him from future office in the bargain because he felt the criminal justice system should be left to hold Trump accountable. Well, that guy whose wife Trump has mocked as, quote, Coco Chow because of her Asian American heritage, and who frequently derided McConnell as, quote, a broken down crow and as a, quote, dumb son of a bitch. That guy, on the morning after this week's Super Tuesday elections, announced his endorsement of Donald J. Trump to be the next president of the United States, because of course he did. Because all is forgiven when it comes to Republicans and holding power, I guess. Said the broken down crow in a statement on subsequent Wednesday, quote, it is abundantly clear that former President Donald Trump has earned the requisite support of Republican voters to be our nominee. for President of the United States, he will have my support. McConnell, who has announced he will step down from his leadership role after this November's elections, is one of the most influential Washington Republicans to back Trump, as Washington Post Josh Dossi describes him today, calling the endorsement a remarkable, if expected, move from the Kentucky Republican. McConnell's move is likely to have little effect with Trump's supporters, the paper notes, but could persuade Republican donors close to McConnell, and there are many of them, to contribute to Trump. McConnell has faced pressure from some Republicans to endorse Trump in recent weeks, though people close to him said most of his supporters and allies were not clamoring for him to do so, but Mitch did it anyway. Despite Trump's comments to the contrary, Mitch McConnell is not a dumb son of a bitch. He may be many things, but he is not that. He hasn't helped burn down this nation's institutions over the past 20 years or so by being a dummy, by not knowing how to read the direction of the political winds. His insurrections, McConnell's, particularly of the corrupted, stolen, and packed U.S. Supreme Court, corrupted and stolen and packed by Mitch McConnell, his insurrections did not happen with pitchforks or torches or bear spray or sharpened flagpoles or hangman's nooses. They happened nonviolently, so they received far less notice from our nation's corporate media. But make no mistake, they did happen. And the U.S. Senate and the U.S. Supreme Court have burned and turned ever since. A Trump advisor said that he welcomed the endorsement from Mitch, and the campaign believes it could help with some donors, because really that's what this is all about, right? Because it's certainly not about the voters, as McConnell's Supreme Court has made certain. They made certain of that some years ago. Whether it was the Citizens United decision opening up the floodgates to corporate money, whether it was knocking down the Voting Rights Act to make it very difficult for many people in this country to vote. Though McConnell, who had held out in recent weeks as other Republicans lined up to bend the knee and kiss the ring of Donald Trump, including many who wanted a different nominee, McConnell's endorsement means that almost every powerful cog in the Republican apparatus at this point, the Republican establishment, the establishment that Trump and his supporters pretend to abhor, well, it seems that pretty much almost every powerful cog in that machine is now directly behind the disgraced former president and his run to win the White House again this November. But not yet everyone. McConnell declared his endorsement as Trump's former U.S. ambassador Nikki Haley announced on subsequent Wednesday morning that she is suspending her campaign, leaving Trump with no remaining major opponents, but declining to offer her endorsement yet.
I am filled with the gratitude for the outpouring of support we've received from all across our great country. But the time has now come to suspend my campaign. I said I wanted Americans to have their voices heard. I have done that. I have no regrets. And although I will no longer be a candidate, I will not stop using my voice for the things I believe in. In all likelihood, Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee when our party convention meets in July. I congratulate him and wish him well. I have always been a conservative Republican and always supported the Republican nominee. But on this question, as she did on so many others, Margaret Thatcher provided some good advice when she said, quote, never just follow the crowd. Always make up your own mind. It is now up to Donald Trump to earn the votes of those in our party and beyond it who did not support him. And I hope he does that. At its best, politics is about bringing people into your cause, not turning them away. And our conservative cause badly needs more people. This is now his time for choosing.
Well, while Haley has yet to endorse Trump, it is clear, if nothing else, from Tuesday's reported results, that Trump will almost certainly need to somehow unite the rest of the Republican Party behind him.
Yes, I mean,
think he'll be able to do that.
I think he will be, because I think that his takeover of the Republican Party has been complete now. And with voter suppression laws that are in place, gerrymandering that is in place, even if he doesn't quite get all of the former Republican voters that voted against him in this primary, a good number of them, I think, will just decide that, you know what, they just can't manage to vote for a Democrat. They'll just have to vote for the dictator wannabe Trump, and that they'll do it. Then there won't be enough people on the Republican side to vote against him.
Well, we will see, because there is a lot of people on the Republican side currently voting against him. And Haley, while she lost overwhelmingly to Trump in the number of states which voted on Super Tuesday and in the previous weeks, she did manage to win like 30 or 40% of the vote in many states, 30 or 40% of the Republican votes. And she even won one of those states on Tuesday. Many of her supporters say they are currently unwilling to back the former president, which could cause him problems in the general election, at least according to exit polling. We will see. Sticking largely with the Republican side of the presidential contest on Tuesday, we'll get to the Democrats a little bit later. But based on the numbers available today, none of which have been verified, I should note, by human beings, and all of which are at least somewhat incomplete as counting and canvassing continues at this hour, and as late-arriving vote-by-mail ballots still need to be processed in most states, Donald Trump won just 80% or more of his party's primary voters in only three of the states that were holding contests on Super Tuesday: Alabama, Oklahoma, and Alaska. He only broke 80% in those three states. In three states, he failed to even crack 60% of the vote. That would be Massachusetts, Utah, and Vermont, where he actually lost to Haley, who won a majority of votes with 50.1% to Trump's 45.9% to win all of the delegates, 17 of them that were on offer in Vermont. Trump barely cracked 60% in Colorado, even if he did manage to win a majority in 14 of 15 states that were voting on Tuesday. His numbers are soft. Compare that with President Biden's victories on Tuesday, as he won, according to results reported on Wednesday afternoon, all 15 states by 80% or better, usually in the high 80s. But for Minnesota and Oklahoma, where he won 70% and 73% respectively, but as noted, we'll get to some of that discussion in a bit. And yet, I suspect there will be a lot of focus on whether Democrats can keep their coalition together in the coming days, and a lot less on the fact that anywhere from 20 to 40% of Republican voters in some 20 states that have voted so far in the primaries voted for someone other than Donald Trump. In fact, as I was watching returns last night, and I don't think we recorded it, unfortunately, but over on CNN, I mentioned it on Twitter, where you can find me at the Brad Blog. But on CNN, their numbers guy on their big magic wall of results, or whatever they call it, Harry Enten, he was going on and on about how Trump was just, quote, dominating on Tuesday night. Super Tuesday. He was having a dominating night, said Enten. He said it several times, as results showed him generally pulling, well, 60 to 80% of the Republican vote in most states, before Enten got around to eventually noting that Joe Biden, who was pulling high 80s in most states, was doing, quote, very well. He did very well.
That was pretty much the story across all of corporate media.
Is that right?
Yes.
Donald Trump dominated. Biden was doing very well. I think that's a sort of a preview of what we may see from the corporate media over the next eight months or so until Election Day. Some more results from Tuesday night, including, as noted, on the Democratic side shortly. But I'm happy to report that at least so far, there was not a lot of problems for voters on Tuesday. Those are the folks I care most about. With voting systems and other complications, mostly not too many problems. Most of the problems with the systems themselves reported so far were in Desi's old home state of Texas on the on the morning of the election, with voting machines that were missing power cables or voter registration computers that had trouble booting or reaching the internet. Though most of those issues reportedly and happily were dealt with in pretty short order. So most voters were not turned away by that. But in Texas, particularly where they use touchscreen voting machines in many jurisdictions, they force Republicans and Democrats to vote on entirely different machines for some reason. And they have Republican judges running the Republican primary, Democrats running the Democratic races, etc. But interestingly, since there was much larger turnout in Texas on the Republican side, in Texas, there are just far more registered Republicans than Democrats, but they also have open primaries. So really, anyone can choose to vote in either primary. But some voters were forced to wait in line for more than an hour when attempting to vote in the Republican primary, even as I saw no reported problems for Democratic voters for a happy change. As noted, however, beyond an hour or so line, which I should note is obscene. But, you know, Texas makes it almost impossible to vote by mail or vote early. But, you know, voters in Texas, they seem to be trained to expect those kind of lines. Hey, Texas, you don't have to if you had a proper voting system. Anyway, most of the reports of the voting system problems there and elsewhere that I've heard of today were unspectacular by modern day standards and otherwise quickly fixed, but not everywhere. Remember that stunning ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court last June when they sort of surprised everyone by agreeing that the state of Alabama must, in fact, yes, add a second black majority or close to it U.S. House district in order to comply with the still standing parts of the Voting Rights Act? Well, Alabama continued to fight that even after the court's ruling, but they were eventually forced to redistrict to include a second district where minority voters have a chance of voting for a candidate of their choosing in a state which has never had more than one such district out of seven U.S. House districts total in Alabama, despite the fact that the population is about 27% African American. Well, as AP reported on Tuesday night, more than 6,000 voters in the newly formed congressional district drawn to heighten black voting power in Alabama received postcards with incorrect voting information ahead of Tuesday's primary, alarming advocates concerned about the potential impact on a race seen as crucial to boosting black representation and Democrats' hopes of flipping the U.S. House in November. James Snipes, chair of the Montgomery County Board of Registrars, said more than 6,500 county voters received postcards listing the incorrect congressional district after the county's election software misidentified some people living in the second congressional district as living in the seventh district.
Oh, dear.
The county had sent about 2,000 notices to affected voters as of Tuesday evening and will send out an additional 4,000 on Wednesday, he said, though it's unclear to me what good those notices sent on Wednesday after the primary will actually do.
Brilliant.
Though he said, quote, everyone who came to their precinct was able to vote for the correct candidates. He attributed the incorrect information to a, quote, software glitch made when adjusting the recent shift in state congressional districts, asserting, quote, this was a good faith effort. Montgomery is home to about 159,000 registered voters. It now falls in the second congressional district after a federal court drew the new congressional lines in November in response to the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling that the state had been diluting the voting power of black residents. The redrawn map could lead to the election of two black congressional representatives in Alabama for the first time in state history. Camille Wimbish, the national director of campaigns for the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, said, quote, for many black voters in that district, this is the first election where they have the opportunity to elect a representative who looks like them. This could have caused many black Alabamans to just stay home and not vote at all. State Rep. Napoleon Bracey, one of 11 Democratic candidates running in the 2nd District primary, said, quote, "It is disappointing to see that voters in Montgomery County are facing classic disenfranchisement." He noted it came days after the state marked an anniversary of key events that led to the passage of the Voting Rights Act. Election officials caught an error in the cards that were sent to voters in January. They attempted to update their system so voters would be listed in the correct district. According to Snipes of the county board, quote, "We thought we had it all fixed," he said, adding that officials didn't realize that more voters had been affected. Quote, "We can't figure out how that software did this to us," he said.
Well, I'll just say that if Alabama Republicans had not delayed and fought for so long, that there might have been a chance for the election officials to get all this stuff sorted out much earlier.
Excellent point. In any event, that was one of the few issues reported on Super Tuesday. There was, you know, sporadic problems that we often see, most of which were resolved quickly. But of course, that report from AP saying few issues, that was before Tuesday night's Republican caucuses in Utah. If you were watching results coming in on Tuesday night, you may have noticed that the Democratic numbers came in fairly quickly in Utah after the polls closed, but the wait for the Republican numbers took much longer. As the Salt Lake Tribune reported at about 10 p.m. on Tuesday night, Utah was poised to join the growing list of states where President Joe Biden has fended off Democratic challengers, according to early primary returns. Whether the Beehive State will back former President Donald Trump for sequel to 2020 is yet to be seen, they reported, as the Utah Republican Party deals with voting system issues on Super Tuesday night. Biden, they note, dominated, they said dominated, in Utah, and he had 88% of the vote as of about 9:45 p.m. when this article came out. According to the early returns, that number largely held up. I think Biden won 87.4% of the vote as of Wednesday afternoon with self-help guru Marianne Williamson and Congressman Dean Phillips each picking up less than 5%. Dean Phillips has since announced that he is suspending his campaign. Marianne Williamson, a few days ago, announced she was suspending her campaign, only to a couple days later get back in the campaign. In any event, focusing on the Republicans for the moment, as of 9:15 p.m., the Utah Republican State Party, Rob Axon, told reporters they were just waiting to hear from about 80% of precincts. So what happened? Why did they have all the Democratic numbers but not the Republican numbers? Well, the Democrats had a standard-issue state-run primary election. The Utah Republican Party, however, chose to have a party-run caucus. Caucuses across the state. And it reportedly did not go well. The Utah GOP urged caucus attendees to pre-register through their website to make the check-in process go smoothly and, of course, to harvest up all of their email addresses and contact information. But apparently, according to the Tribune, chaos ensued on Tuesday night after the party's digital systems crashed at multiple caucus locations. At several of them, lack of internet slowed things down and even stopped the process, leaving attendees stuck in long lines. Caucus goers also had problems with the party's online system, further following up the voting process. At Copper Hills High School, those problems reportedly caused hundreds of potential attendees to give up and go home. A volunteer at the GOP caucus at Riverton High School said the website did not seem to be working properly. Quote, "So when people come up, either their voter ID doesn't seem to load, even though they've been voting for a long time," he said, "or when we try and look them up by their name and address, that's not coming up either." Evelyn Ames, a Riverton caucus goer, said after voting for Trump twice in previous years, she was voting for Haley this year, but Ames was frustrated with the caucus system on Tuesday night. Quote, "This is the stupidest thing I've ever been in," she said. "It was a pure waste of my time." She said she only realized on Tuesday morning that she was voting for president, not the other candidates listed on the GOP's website. Quote, and I didn't know that, she said. I think the Republican Party did a disservice to us by not helping us understand what was actually happening, she said. She was also frustrated by having to spend an evening voting at the caucus as opposed to simply voting with a primary ballot. She said it gives you between 6 and 9 o'clock to vote, and if it were a regular primary, I could send in my ballot anytime. One couple who attended the Riverton caucus said they'd first gone to Harriman High School, were sent from there to Draper, and from there to Riverton, only to be told that they should be caucusing at Harriman High School. Another caucus goer said he had been to 3 different locations, and Riverton was his 4th stop. Voters were told they were at the wrong location. They were rushed out. They rushed out the door to try to make it in time to cast their vote at a different location. In the end, it's still unclear as of today how many voters in a state where Trump is not particularly popular, even among Republicans, unclear how many voters were actually able or unable to cast their vote. Trump ended up winning the state, according to caucus results that were finally reported as of this afternoon, though only 75% of those results are currently available. Just 57% of the vote went to Donald Trump. That ain't much. That doesn't sound like domination to me. 57% for Trump, 42% for Nikki Haley. Might she have done better but for the failure by Republicans to run their own caucuses properly using their own computers? Well, we may never know. When there's only one opportunity to cast a vote in this case over just 3 hours and computer systems fail, well, votes are lost forever. And please do keep in mind that this is exactly the type of system that Donald Trump and his party are now calling for the entire nation. No early voting, no vote by mail voting. They're against all of that. Only ballots cast on election day should be counted. And if the voting systems, the computers go sideways, well, oh well. The important thing, I guess, is that Donald Trump won. And really, that's all that counts, right? Democracy for all. Domination for all. Democracy for all. Apparently that's for cheaters and losers or something. More Super Tuesday madness after this. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At The Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back to The Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com with our Super Tuesday results coverage. And it may continue for a while. There was a lot of stuff going on across the country. Aside from the presidential contest, there were a lot of other races way down the ballot. We may dig into some of those on a future program, since progressives did have a number of victories in a number of key district attorney races around the country, apparently, where voters appear to be pushing back on the so-called soft-on-crime campaign that the right has been attempting to stoke against Democrats in recent months. There were also some critical judge races, though, like the DA contest, a number of them were out here in California, where, yes, we take our time.
Yes, we do.
To tally results. So I don't want to get ahead of myself, but there were a number of noteworthy races of national note on Tuesday, particularly in Texas and North Carolina. In the Great Lone Star State, Democratic Congressman and former NFL pro Colin Allred was chosen by Texas voters to face off this November against Republican U.S. Senator Ted Cruz. Democrats believe that the state is trending in their direction, and they argue that Cruz is vulnerable after he barely won re-election back in 2018 by just 3 percentage points. So we'll see what happens this November when Allred versus Cruz. In the great Tar Heel state of North Carolina, where gerrymandered Republicans in the state legislature have radically re-gerrymandered the U.S. House districts this year and were allowed to do so by a crooked state court system and a crooked U.S. Supreme Court system, which recently declared that federal courts could not block partisan gerrymanders. So have at it, Republicans. In North Carolina, the state's Republican lieutenant governor, Governor Mark Robinson, a Trump-endorsed Holocaust denier and all-around radical right-wing loon, frankly, he won his primary race bigly to win the nomination for governor in the critical battleground state this year. He will face North Carolina's Democratic Attorney General Josh Stein in the contest to replace the state's termed-out Democratic governor, Roy Cooper. And I believe I can hear Democrats cheering about Tuesday's results in that particular race from the on the GOP side. I think I can hear them cheering from here.
Yeah, sure. But it sounds like it's going to get to be a really nasty race. If you've got the Republican nominee who is a Holocaust denier and an anti-Semite running against the Jewish attorney general, I think it's going to get really, really ugly.
Well, I guess it will. We'll see. It'll probably boost turnout bigly as
well.
We will see. Also in North Carolina, however, on that freshly gerrymandered U.S. House map that is now in use this year, does the name Mark Harris ring a bell?
Not for me.
All right. Well, it will in a second, because it looks like he may be making his way back to Congress. North Carolina Republican Mark Harris.
Oh, yes.
Now you're getting
now
it.
Now it's coming back.
He's the lead. He's leading in his primary in North Carolina's 8th congressional district, just above the threshold to avoid a runoff with about 95% of the vote now said to be tallied. So if the name sounds familiar to you, it's because his apparent victory in a similar district race back in 2018 was tossed out entirely after the election by the state election board, after it became clear that an operative for Harris's campaign had been hired, a guy by the name of McCray Dowless, hired by Harris's campaign, allegedly to mastermind a scheme to illegally collect and mark absentee ballots from voters. Went house to house, said, I'll fill that in for you. The very thing that Republicans like to claim that Democrats do while they were busy actually doing that thing in the U.S. House race in 2018, and the results of the election had to be thrown out once all of this came to light. The operative, McCray Dowless, by the way, he died in 2022 before he could go to trial in that case. The state election board held a hearing after the election when this came to light, before they tossed out the results, where the son of Mark Harris, who in addition to being a congressman was also supposedly a preacher, but his son testified that his dad knew about Dowless's history of stealing elections when they hired him. Mark Harris ended up crying on the witness stand, much drama during the hearing. He eventually walked out after all of it, and a new election had to be held. Harris did not run again in that new election, and another Republican, Dan Bishop, narrowly won the seat. We thought that was the last we would hear from Mark Harris, but in the Trump era, anything apparently is possible. Crimes, even attempted stolen elections, obviously do not actually matter. With Bishop, Congressman Bishop, deciding to leave the House in order to run for the state AG seat in North Carolina this year. He ran uncontested for that Republican nomination on Tuesday. Mark Harris announced his comeback bid, and despite an effort from some deep-pocketed super PACs to try to stop him, it looks like he may be headed back to the U.S. House next year. He's currently at 30.4% in the GOP primary. That is just above the 30% threshold that is needed to avoid a runoff in the state. AP has now called the race for Mark Harris. If he manages to stay above 30%, and we don't find that, you know, he tried to steal this election too, well, his ticket back to D.C. is basically guaranteed, with the 8th district now an even deeper red district this year. So see, redemption is possible, even for attempted election thieves in the Trump era. though not necessarily for everyone. So for that, we had to go back to Texas, where Ryan Zink. No, not Ryan Zinke, the Trump's corrupt former
Interior Secretary.
Now a corrupt sitting U.S. congressman again, I think.
Yep.
But Ryan Zink, who was convicted for his role in the January 6th insurrection. On Tuesday night, Zink lost the House Republican primary in Texas's 19th congressional district to incumbent Jody Arrington.
Yay.
Zink actually recorded himself, as these geniuses do, entering the Capitol that day saying, quote, "We're storming the Capitol. You can't stop us." Well, he has been convicted, but he's not yet sentenced. So in the meantime, well, to fill the time, he ran for Congress. He did receive more than 1,700 votes from Texas Republicans, however, but it was not enough. He came in fourth against a sitting incumbent Republican member of Congress. Quick break, and we're back with more Post Super Tuesday coverage as we move to the Democratic side right after this. I'm Brad, and you're listening to the Bradcast. Hey, it's Brad. Well, we are here in another critical presidential election year. We cover elections like no other outlet in the nation. This election year will be a big one like none other. It could even be the last one, depending on how it goes. Seriously. Please help the Bradcast continue in this critical election year. Support our work right now with a generous donation via bradblog.com/donate. Help keep the Bradcast and bradblog.com free for all. We couldn't do any of this without you. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate right now. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Like a sound you hear that lingers in your ear, but you can't forget from sundown to sunset. Nah, nah. It's all in the air, you hear it everywhere. No matter what you do, it's gonna grab a hold on you.
Right.
California soul. California soul.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com with plenty of California soul. We will get there in a moment. Joe Biden dominated on Tuesday night. Let it be known. Let it be said, as CNN's Harry Enten might have said, if, you know, favors to Donald Trump weren't so baked into the cake of the corporate media at this point.
True.
Don't even know that he realized he was doing that. But Joe Biden did not win everywhere, believe it or not. Democratic candidate Jason Palmer. Wait, what? Who? Jason Palmer won the American Samoa Democratic presidential caucuses on Tuesday, handing President Joe Biden his only defeat so far this primary system. Who is Jason Palmer? I don't know. Apparently neither did anyone else, as the networks then went scrambling to try to figure it out on Tuesday. Palmer is apparently a business executive from Baltimore, Maryland, according to his campaign website. He launched his extremely long shot bid for president in November. Well, I guess it's not quite as long now, huh? He was also on the ballot on Tuesday in Colorado and Vermont. Didn't do as well there. He received 0.7% and 0.6% of the vote, respectively, in Colorado and Vermont. He was the only Democrat to actually campaign, however, in American Samoa. He sponsored several beach cleanups on the island, which is about 2,500 miles southwest of Hawaii. See, showing up and campaigning can make a difference.
Well, sure, and also being a really wealthy person does, too.
Is he a wealthy person?
Yes, he is.
As a territory, Samoa does not get a vote in the general presidential election, actually, which I think is terrible. That's the case with all of these territories. They're only permitted to send delegates to the Democratic convention during the primary season. So Palmer's platform apparently includes support for a ceasefire in Gaza, expanding a path to citizenship for migrants, and support for unions. Sounds like a good candidate. Back in 2020, in American Samoa, Biden didn't win that year either. He captured just 8% of the vote in Samoa. He came in fourth. Bernie Sanders came in third. Tulsi Gabbard came in second. She represents Hawaii, so maybe that's not all that surprising. But I guess when it comes to people with money, as Desi Doyen says, actually it was Michael Bloomberg who won back then. He won when roughly 230 Samoans voted in that year's Democratic presidential caucuses. This year, Palmer edged out a sitting president with 56% of the vote to Biden's 44%. Palmer won four delegates. Biden won two. Sounds like a huge victory, but the raw numbers may tell the real story here. Palmer received 51 votes total. He defeated Biden by 11 votes total as the president picked up 40 votes in American Samoa to Palmer's 51.
Now, see, Joe, it pays to actually go and campaign in person.
And it's a lovely vacation spot. I don't know why he wouldn't want to go there.
He might be a little busy.
I don't believe there were any exit pollsters on hand in American Samoa, however, to tell us why it is that Palmer ended up winning. So we just had to fill in our own guesses here. Who knows? Perhaps it was his call for a ceasefire in Gaza. If so, it would not be the only place that concerns from Democratic voters made their way into the results on Tuesday, though perhaps not as much as some may think. Washington Post's Philip Bump looked into this and noted that several states that voted on Tuesday included an uncommitted or similar ballot option and had cast a significant chunk of their vote for that option back in 2012, when the incumbent Democratic president on the ballot at the time was Barack Obama. And in most of those states, uncommitted got a smaller percentage of votes cast than this year than that option 12 years ago. So I know a lot of folks have been making, you know, noise about, well, the uncommitted, this may show that the Democratic coalition is falling apart. Well, in most states that have that option, actually, back in 2012, more people voted for uncommitted than they did this year. So last week, the surge in uncommitted votes did appear in Michigan. It was seen as a statement of frustration with the Biden administration's policy on Israel's war in Gaza. There was actually a campaign specifically meant to protest that. About 13% of the Democratic voters voted for uncommitted. But that was not all that much, actually, compared to just about 11% who did the same thing back in 2012 in Michigan. A similar campaign was underway in Minnesota on Tuesday. Now, in 2012, less than 4% of the vote in Minnesota went to uncommitted. As we go to air, that percentage is much, much higher, with, in fact, about 19% of the Democratic primary voters in the state voting for uncommitted in a state with a very large Arab American population. That said, for context, it should be noted that in Alabama and Massachusetts and North Carolina and Tennessee, the percentage voting for uncommitted is down, often substantially so, as Philip Bump noticed. As he assesses, the protest against Biden may not be particularly novel, and secondly, that these protest votes are not a barrier to Biden's reelection. So Philip Bump sees it that way, maybe. But Democrats, frankly, proceed at their own peril without taking notice of these concerns from voters. 19% in Minnesota, a swing state, is, well, that's a lot of voters. 13% in Michigan, another battleground state, that's a lot of voters. And it was hard to not notice on Tuesday night after Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff was declared the first place winner in his race for the primary race for the open U.S. Senate seat out here in California this year, where he ran against two other House progressives, Congresswoman Katie Porter and the legendary Barbara Lee. And against the Republican candidate and former Major League Baseball star Steve Garvey. As noted, we take a while to count our votes accurately out here in California, but the numbers are large enough that media have at least been able to call the race by now for Schiff coming in first place and Garvey in our top two primary system, meaning that the top two vote getters of any party go on to compete in the general election. So, sadly, with Schiff coming in first place, Garvey coming in second place, and followed by eventually Porter and Barbara Lee, much lower down, clearly not enough votes that they will overtake them unless there is a surprise, unless there's some sort of surprise that we did not know about in the voting system.
Which is really unlikely.
It looks like, it is going to be Adam Schiff and Steve Garvey. So, sadly, both Lee and Porter... they will not be running for the Senate. I know they had both hoped to at least come in the top two, in which case we would have had two Democrats running against each other in California this fall. Adam Schiff actually didn't really campaign against either Barbara Lee or Katie Porter, focusing instead on making sure that Steve Garvey, he actually helped Steve Garvey to win that second slot, figuring it would be easier to defeat and cheaper to defeat a Republican out here in heavily blue California than it would be to have a Democrat on Democrat fight this November. So sadly, Lee and Porter will not only not be running for the U.S. Senate, they will also no longer be in the U.S. House, which I find to be very sad, frankly.
Yes, it's a big loss for everybody, not just California.
It is, yeah. But as to those protesting the Biden administration's position in Gaza, yes, out here in California, well, those protesters made themselves heard pretty loud and pretty clear on Tuesday night at Adam Schiff's victory party when they protested, chanting "Ceasefire now" during his victory speech.
Ceasefire now! Ceasefire! Yeah. We are so lucky to live in a democracy where we all have the right to protest. We are so lucky to live in that kind of democracy, and we want to make sure that we keep this kind of democracy.
So that was on Tuesday night during the speech. I think he actually handled that very well.
Yes.
And the protesters, they kept going.
Through the entire speech.
Through the entire speech, all the way through to the end when, Schiff just kept going at some point. I think
somebody came out and just said, "Do you want to go?" Or it appeared to be so, and he waved them off.
He waved them away. He said no, and he kept going. And he even acknowledged them again at the acknowledgement section of his speech at the end of his remarks.
But I also want to acknowledge again my great gratitude to all of my wonderful supporters. I want to acknowledge the right of our protesters, and I look forward to working with you all and onward to victory in November. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you. And let's go on and win this thing. On to November, everybody. And thank you for all your support.
So there you go. He acknowledged the right of our protesters.
And said, "I would look forward to working with you. Let's win this thing in November," which it is kind of important that Democrats hold the Senate, because that's sort of the last bastion of preventing bad things from happening in Congress.
Well, we'll see. At this point, I think the odds on favorite is for the Democrats to pick up get the majority back in the U.S. House and maybe lose the U.S. Senate. They've
exactly.
got a whole lot of seats
vulnerable
that they have
seats.
To defend. Yeah, vulnerable seats in the U.S. Senate. So we will see. But I just thought it was kind of a nice change of pace. I was glad to hear the protesters speaking out. It sounded like there was a lot of them there, but it was a nice change of pace to see a candidate, you know, not shout them down, not tell people to, you know, punch them out, run them out of here, as Donald Trump famously did through his various campaigns whenever anybody dared to show up to protest any particular position of his. But yeah, that sounded like a lot of people. Now, I think that a lot of Democrats may now be sort of downplaying the concerns. As you heard Philip Bump, he's not a Democrat, works for Washington Post, but he says, based on this on the numbers, it's not a huge concern, he said. But I don't know, that's a lot of people in swing states like Minnesota and Michigan. So again, I think they downplay those concerns among the Democratic coalition regarding Israel and the administration's stance on it at their own peril. Now, it does seem that the Biden administration is hearing the complaints. And in fact, I was going to say are hearing the complaints. I don't know. Bad grammar. In any event, as you probably have heard by now, the administration has joined with a number of other countries in airdrops of food and humanitarian aid to Gaza. That's good. That's a good start. Too little, maybe arguably too late, given that there are hundreds of thousands who are on the brink of death right now from starvation. But I'm glad it is underway. And the administration from the beginning has said that they have been pushing the far-right Netanyahu administration in Israel to do the right thing. It hasn't helped, apparently. Well, it has to some extent. We did have a short ceasefire there. We have had some of the hostages returned. There's a lot of folks on the Democratic side who are not happy at all with the way things are going, with the way the Biden administration is running their Israel policy, even if they might oppose what Benjamin Netanyahu is doing. So it was with that in mind that cheers erupted on Sunday when Vice President Kamala Harris called for, quote, an immediate ceasefire and more humanitarian aid into Gaza, saying that people in the region are, quote, starving in the face of, quote, inhumane conditions, and urging Israel to do more in one of the strongest public pushes, in any event, by a U.S. official to date. Harris was in Selma, Alabama to commemorate the 5th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. 59th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, which led eventually to the Voting Rights Act. She says she has been monitoring the unfolding humanitarian crisis in Gaza closely and has been involved in the post-conflict planning for the besieged coastal enclave, if we can ever get to the post-conflict part of this disaster. But her Sunday remarks, as CNN reports, marked an escalation in the U.S. push to address the situation in Gaza, noting that, quote, the Israeli government must do more to significantly increase the flow of aid. No excuses, she said.
Given the immense scale of suffering in Gaza, there must be an immediate ceasefire. Yeah! For at least the next 6 weeks, which is what is currently on the table. This will get the hostages out and get a significant amount of aid in. This would allow us to build something more enduring, to ensure Israel is secure, and to respect the right of the Palestinian people to dignity, freedom, and self-determination. Hamas claims it wants a ceasefire. Well, there is a deal on the table. And as we have said, Hamas needs to agree to that deal. Let's get a ceasefire. Let's reunite the hostages with their families. And let's provide immediate relief to the people of Gaza.
That was Vice President Kamala Harris on Sunday in Alabama calling for an immediate ceasefire, at least long enough to get out some more hostages and get in some more humanitarian aid to the besieged enclave. That amidst protests from Democrats about the administration's position. So we'll see if that makes a difference. It seems clear that the administration has noticed these concerns, is trying to speak to these concerns.
It does seem like that. And also, they've been working behind the scenes, apparently, reportedly. It is nice to see them actually come out publicly and do much more in that direction.
Do much more, and I think they still need to keep going.
Yes.
But we'll see, because many people have said, oh, that's great. Too little, too late. We will see. It's going to be an interesting year, to say the least. A couple of quick notes before we get out. Some news that has broken since we have gone to air here today. The House has passed a $460 billion spending bill to fund the government, about half of the federal government through the fall, through September, it looks like, to avert a partial shutdown, at least for now.
Until September, right, as we are in the thick of the run-up to the November election.
It'll make it lively, Des.
Oh, sure.
It's going to be, otherwise it's going to be a totally boring election season. So this will, you know, add a little spice to it. Anyway, that is now headed over to the Senate. We'll see. I don't even know what's in it because it has just broken here. But I don't know if it includes House GOP poison pills or not, but it's headed over to the Senate. It sounds like it may be passed in the Senate from what I'm just the headlines that I'm seeing. But of course, they still have to do the same thing for the other half of the government, for things like the Defense Department and so forth. So that bill is expected in a few days as well to keep the government from shutting down if the House GOP can pull their blank together in
their
order
stuff
to govern. That all in advance of this Thursday's State of the Union address by Joe Biden, speaking of keeping things lively. Huh. So that's all ahead. There was one more here. Arizona. Apparently, prosecutors in the state have issued grand jury subpoenas in their state investigation of efforts by Donald Trump and his allies to steal the 2020 election results in that state. So it never ends.
It is good to see some wheels of justice turning a little
especially
more.
Especially state wheels of justice, because we've seen how easily Donald Trump is able to, use the Supreme Court.
The federal judiciary that he packed.
To get him off the hook here. We'll see. We'll see if that's successful. But in the meantime, these state level prosecutions are apparently critical. All right, we got to get out. My thanks to Desi Doyen. Feel better, Des. And my thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other we have ever done, you can download all of them for free at bradblog.com. Why? Well, because folks like you have stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves now and keep blogging at Bradblog for more than 20 years. Thank you to all of you who help us do that. It is really difficult right around now, so it is greatly appreciated if you can stop by bradblog.com/donate. Hey, think about signing up for a subscription. We keep the blog free for all and the show, the radio show, and everything else free for all. But it would really help if we could sign up a few more subscribers today. Bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, you will find me at TheBradBlog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, hopefully tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.